Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
This episode of Lending Forward is brought to you by LoanCare, a leading national mortgage subservicer that's been raising standards across the industry for more than 40 years. LoanCare delivers smarter solutions that drive portfolio retention and performance for lenders. Tap into their powerful analytics, proprietary consumer-facing technology, and client-centric approach that demonstrates their commitment to being a true subservicing partner and extension of your team. Discover how LoanCare delivers a servicing experience that feels like your own at loancareservicing.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I am Bill Hitchcock, Senior Vice President of Business Development here at Atlantic Bay Mortgage, and we are excited to have another episode of Lending Forward. And today, excited to have our guest, Mr. Rob Zimmer. Welcome, Rob.
Hello, good morning.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So Rob has been, you're exactly Director of External Affairs at Community Home Lenders of America, CHLA, which for those of you that know or don't know, it's a national trade association that advocates in Washington for small and mid-sized community-based mortgage bankers. And Rob has served as a number of different roles within the organization. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, you know, Rob, also is that you have a background or, you know, former U.S. Army captain. So, you know, it's great, you know, that you served. So in some of the things that we're going to be talking about today around, you know, VA loans and different things that are impacting our community, you've got that background from kind of, you know, really being literally boots on the ground. So thanks for joining us today, Rob.
My first mortgage was a VA mortgage a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm sure was the paperwork more or less? I'm not sure.
Here's what I remember is that back then it was a very clunky product, and it was the mortgage rate was more expensive than a conventional, which is no longer the case. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. It's nice to see that. There's been improvements there. And it's funny because when you say paperwork, I guess it truly was paperwork,
but,
back then, not to date anybody, but hey, my first mortgage was fully paper as well. I was joking around with some people in the office, and we were talking about when we got into the mortgage business. So, like Atlantic Bay, I'm going on 30 years in the mortgage business. And we were joking around like that back when we started, you pull a credit report, and it was on the reams of paper, and everybody was kind of running around saying like, hey, do you have a page of my credit report? You know, because somebody ripped off, you know, too much. So not to date myself either, but those were the good old days, right?
Yeah, the good old days. It's someday our kids will be like, how did you ever close a mortgage at all that way?
Right. So Rob, I got to ask you also, so, you know, looking at your bio kind of, prepping for our episode today, I noticed that you've got ties to both Harvard and Syracuse. So now who do you pull for?
Yeah, it's tough. And Syracuse, when I was there, the football team was very good. They were in bowls every year. It was the first college covered dome stadium, I think. There weren't many covered stadiums in 1980, 81. And it was the Carrier Dome, right? Named
right.
by an air conditioning company. They didn't have enough data to model how such a place would work, because there was like the Astrodome, one other place, and the Carrier Dome. The first football game, they set the thermostat wrong. The temperature went up to 75 degrees, and the male kids were tearing off their shirts. It was so hot in the Carrier Dome.
Yeah.
The other funny thing I'll tell you is, if you go to the Harvard football stadium, they talk about all their national championships, like in the 1890s, you know, when
they
had a total of eight teams playing college football. Very proud of those national championships from over 130 years ago.
Yeah. Could you imagine if, and I'm a big college football fan, but could you imagine if you have an Ivy League school actually come back and win the national championship? And, you know, in today's environment, like, you know, if Harvard, you know, beats Alabama for the national championship.
World ends the next day.
Yeah. That would be pretty incredible. But yeah, excited to have you on. And I want to jump right in. You know, we know that these episodes go quick and we probably won't even scratch the surface of all the things that we could touch on. But, you know, I know that one of the things that you have, you know, so much focus on and kind of oversight over is, you know, right now with VA loans. So there's so much that's, you know, there's so much news in general. But, you know, if you could kind of break it down for us a little bit, you know, right now you mentioned that that was the first loan that you did, and the VA loan as a tool, as a resource, you know, when CHLA, when you're looking at it, you're advocating for it, give us some of the background of how you are looking at that program.
Well, the program, as you know, to get a no down program, you've either got to live in a rural area with an income limit under the Department of Ag Rural Development Program, or you've got to be a U.S. veteran or active duty person. It's a very valuable benefit. I think lenders have to market it differently because, and I'll tell you why. I got out of the Army, and when you're young and someone says, oh, you know, here's of the many benefits you get as a veteran, you also get a no-down mortgage. And when you're young, you're like, you don't care about that stuff. You don't focus on it. And then I was stunned when I got out. And I was married and a child on the way. And I looked at this and I said, now I get it, right? At 28 years old, I finally figured it out. What a tremendous asset it is.
Right.
A lot of young people coming out of the military, they're not at the age yet where they understand mortgage markets or how valuable this benefit is. And I think lenders got to get out there and find these veterans, really, and literally be the ones to say, do you realize that your earned benefit can do this for you? I was astounded that I could get, you know, a mortgage note with essentially no money down. I was like, why do they trust me that much? So it's a great tool. And I know the mortgage industry's gotten better at making sure that veterans get a VA, but there's still more work to do because a lot of veterans still don't really understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think a lot of it is around awareness on both sides, right? As being the lenders, we can go out and, of course, market it more, but I think sometimes it's almost like you feel like it's an uphill battle because the veterans feeling like, or active duty is feeling like they're being sold something. Do you feel like there's equal awareness on, you know, from their command, or like you said, when you kind of signed up, they said, hey, here's one of the benefits. Do you feel like the military, as a whole, are they advocating for, the program as much?
I don't know. And it's been a while since I exited active duty. And I think the challenge is that once you're out, unless you join a reserve unit, no one talks about it, right? No one's reaching out to you from the Veterans Administration saying, hey, are you thinking of buying a home? That's not really their job. You know, once you as a veteran say, I want a VA mortgage and you start the process, then the VA gets, as you know, really involved, especially if you fall behind in payments. One of the beauties of the VA program is if you get 30, 60 days behind, the VA is aware of it. And other mortgage programs, you know, no, there's no one really aware of it except the lender itself and maybe the servicer, but the VA's on it. That's one reason why it has a, you know, for its average credit score and DTI, it's a remarkably safe program. And I think going back, at one point, 2 years ago, I looked back like 15 years and the default rate was on a par with conventional market, which is astonishing, right? Given that really reaching down and helping people buy that first home. We're also concerned at CHLA, we've been concerned for a while that Congress uses the guarantee fee on VA mortgages as a pay for other veterans programs. And we watched this closely because at one point when Congress passed the Blue Water Navy bill, they added, today it's the guarantee fee is like 215 basis points for a first time buyer. And it's 330 for a subsequent use, right? Unless you're disabled. Mm-hmm. And for a while, Congress jacked up those guarantee fees to 230 basis points for first time and 360 basis points for subsequent use, which made it the single most expensive, you know, federal mortgage program. And we rolled that back because we said that's just wrong. Even today, I think they still use mortgage guarantee fees on the VA program to fund non-housing benefits for veterans, and we're continually lobbying against that.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, let's back up for a second. So you just kind of gave a quick snapshot of some of the work that CHLA does. You know, tell us a little bit more about that, where you see, like, if, you know, people walking away from the show today, like, what do you want them to know and recognize about CHLA and the work that, you know, that you're doing?
Yeah, that's a good question, Bill. And I think I can give a fairly good answer here without droning on and on. And that is, lenders who are busy serving their customers. And I know that everyone serves more than first-time buyers, but first-time buyers are very key, and you guys do a good job of it. They themselves can't really focus. They don't have the staff to focus on the big picture Washington regulatory sphere. They just don't. So they become part of a trade group, and it's the trade group's job to do a lot of things. Make sure that small lenders are not overregulated, because they'll get squeezed. We want to maintain small lenders in this country. We don't want to be like Europe, where you have to deal with large lenders only. And if Washington regulates all lenders the same way, we'll end up with one size lender, large. Why? Because the more regulations you pile on a lender, they have to hire more lawyers and compliance people. And they're good people, but they're not making loans. Large lenders can amortize a large book of business and hire a lot of lawyers and compliance people. Small lenders just can't. They can't do it. It's a fixed cost that doesn't earn them money. Does that make sense? So we're going to make sure that you're not overregulated. We're going to make sure that Washington doesn't tack on a lot of fees to mortgage programs. We've talked about the VA mortgage being used to pay for non-housing benefits for veterans, which is really not right at all. FHA premiums are too high because Congress uses them to fund non-housing programs. And even Fannie and Freddie pay 10 basis points every year. I forget the original reason why Congress did this, but Congress just takes 10 basis points to fund other things. Mm-hmm. It's not fair that basically young families pay extra fees to buy their home. And by the way, a lot of the fees then pay for older Americans like you and me. And that... It's not right for a lot of reasons.
I know, right? See, yeah, Rob, that's why I like having you on, right? You always make me feel good about myself. not older, we're just wiser. That's all.
We are trying to be wiser every day, you and I.
All right, well, Rob, you said the W word, so you know you brought up Washington. So looking at Washington, and you know, kind of current state of affairs, what are you seeing as far as upcoming initiatives that you think are going to have the greatest impact on veteran home buyers?
Well, Congress passed a bill for a partial indemnification program, and it's just getting put into play for the VA. And traditionally, VA didn't have one the way that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and FHA had a way to help people who were in trouble. The VA did not. And one reason was the statute was different. And another reason, without going down a rabbit hole, is that the VA guarantee, you know, is only 25% and not 100% like an FHA loan. And in the case of Fannie and Freddie, they basically take the credit risk. So FHA, if they created a second program and it was already fully backed by the taxpayer, they could do that. And VA, where it's only 25% backed by the taxpayer, they couldn't figure out how to get a second program in that didn't cost a lot of money. So Congress did this. It's just getting rolled out now, and I think it's something worth watching. CHLA worked hard on that. I'll also say trigger leads, as you know, passed successfully. Why was trigger leads a problem? Well, trigger leads was a problem because if you're a family and you're buying a home or moving, like a veteran or active duty family, and you get literally hundreds of texts, email, phone calls, it's very disruptive to your life. And technology evolved in such a way that trigger leads just got out of hand. And so we worked very hard on that bill. It passed. Obviously, lenders, if you have a relationship already with the family, you're allowed to basically try to retain them for a refinance opportunity. But if you have no relationship with the lender going forward, a family's not supposed to get all these calls, texts, and email. And then
it's
to play too.
Right, right. And I think that you've done some work, you know, with Housing Wire on that as well, kind of bringing more awareness, you know, to that situation. And I think people sometimes, if you've been, I don't want to say a victim of it, but if you've been part of it, you know how outrageous it is. You know, you sit there and you apply for a loan, and next thing you know, you're getting tons of, you know, mail and text and calls and everything. And I think also it muddies the water over what is legit and what could potentially be a scam too, because there's just so much of it. And even though you try to be diligent and say, okay, this is the lender that I worked with, and they've told me here are the people that are part of, you know, their process. You make that one mistake and you click on the one link that, you know, you didn't mean to. And next thing you know, here you are. Was that talked a lot about too, around just the security around, around this?
Absolutely. It was, it was the Wild West. And to make things worse, as you know, oftentimes the families getting harassed this way, who did they blame? They blamed their lender. They thought this was all coming from their lender. And the poor lenders are like, it's not us.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you just have a very pissed off customer, and you can tell them it's not us. But a lot of these people, they were like, I don't know who it is, so I don't like any of y'all right now.
Yeah. It's not fun to be, you know, not liked when you're, you know, you're lending. And you know, it's funny because, you know, you and I talked about this a little bit too. When you think of being in this business, it can seem kind of like cliche, but, you know, ultimately the role that we're playing as lenders to help somebody get into a home. So you're trying to do that with as few hurdles as possible. And I think that, you know, everything that was around the trigger leads just created more hurdles, more work for everybody. So hopefully, hopefully all of the work that you all did there, we start to see, you know, some of the relief from that. So yeah, thanks for all that you all did there.
That relief should be coming this year for sure, and probably next year as the systems get put into place to police it. Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And then so Rob, I know that there have been, you know, talks and actually, you know, action around reforms with Fannie and Freddie. And I'm not sure if that keeps you up at night or gets you up early, but what's in your purview? How are you seeing what's happening there? And again, how might, you know, those changes affect, you know, all buyers and specifically to the you know, to our VA buyers?
Yeah, Bill, when Fannie and Freddie were first put into conservatorship, you probably remember that there was an effort in Congress to essentially remake the whole secondary market. There was a bill that even got out of the Senate Banking Committee on a relatively narrow vote that said Fannie and Freddie were going to go away and we were going to have multiple guarantors. And small lenders, I remember talking to my board about this, and I said, well, the consensus in Washington is that Fannie and Freddie have to go away. And every single person on the board, you know, lenders like Atlantic Bay, they said, if Fannie and Freddie go away, we won't be in business, because the uncertainty costs alone, you know, while they're remaking the whole secondary, whenever it resettles again, years from now, we'll be gone. We'll be out of business. And it sounded extreme, except it was every single small lender on the board. And so I said to them, I said at the time, and this must have been 2013 or 14, I said, okay, we can take the position that Fannie and Freddie have to survive, but we'll be the only one saying this. And the small lender board said, well, then we'll be the only one saying this. So we then had to build a coalition to defeat this legislation. And we said, we need reform, but we don't want to kill Fannie and Freddie, because then the big banks benefit and they'll corner that market too. And then we're all in trouble. It was the uncertainty cost would drive them out, and the consolidation would drive them out. So here we are today. They've been largely reformed. They're in conservatorship. The Trump administration has said they're going to come out. I don't know when. I know there's been public statements saying there might be a public offering in November or December. I don't know when it's going to happen. My gut, and I could be wrong, my gut tells me that it's probably next year. And if they don't get it done by July and you get close to midterms, Washington tends to ease up a little bit approaching the term, because they're worried about getting something wrong and risk. So if they have a window next year to have some kind of an offering, if they don't get it done by July, it'll roll over to 2027. Can they offer stock with these companies still in conservatorship? I doubt it. So what does that mean? I think, and I don't have any, let's just declare right now, I don't have any inside information. I don't know. Nobody knows. But it sounds to me like they would be released under a consent order, which they use in the banking world, they're out of conservatorship, but there's a lot more strictures on them and limitation and milestones they have to achieve. And the consent order is there for, call it 2, 3, or 4 years. And once you achieve all the milestones of the consent order then goes away. So it's, I would call it, they'll enter this, you know, people think it's binary. They're either in conservatorship or they're not. I think it's going to be this midway where they're out of conservatorship, they're operating on their own, they can sell stock, a secondary offering to investors, and then they still have to earn their way out of the consent order to be fully released. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's a path, but it could be a long road.
A longer road than people think.
Yeah. And then, so, I mean, that path in that direction, is that, do you see that as ultimately being beneficial to, you know, to the end user, to the customer? Or is this just, you know, kind of a, you know, smoke and mirrors to make a lot of people some money, and the end, you know, product for the consumer is pretty much still the same?
Yeah, very good question. And the good news is I do have an answer here, because you're right. This has got to be done for a specific benefit to the marketplace and to the American consumer. And the answer, here's the answer. First, we have been lobbying to make sure that any action taken here does not raise mortgage rates, which means there's got to be an implicit guarantee. And President Trump said there will be one. And we also are working on Washington to reduce the spread between mortgage money and the 10-year Treasury rate, because it's elevated right now. We're asking Treasury and FHFA to allow Fannie and Freddie to buy more MBS as a backstop bid to reduce that spread, reduce mortgage rates. But also, here's the big picture answer to your question. Fannie and Freddie were chartered to have, if you will, the advantages of the private sector and, you know, public policy making out of Washington. They are supposed to be a hybrid. They're not supposed to replicate what HUD does, the VA, Ginnie Mae, wholly owned government entities. There's advantages to those too, and they're doing a good job. But if you're fully controlled by the government, you can't innovate and be nimble the way that the private sector is and does, and what we need to do to help families. Government's too slow to react and need some new ideas here. And if you're fully controlled by the government, it's much harder to keep up with the marketplace. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's got to be released. Mortgage rates will stay the same or go down slightly. And they've got to keep up with, for example, does anyone think young families are getting well served right now in the mortgage marketplace? I can't find anyone who thinks they are being well served. So let's get some new ideas and not just look in the rear view mirror as we drive our car.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And thanks for kind of making that digestible, I think, for, you know, myself and for, you know, for our listeners. The other part that I want to touch on too is a lot of what you've talked about just in the short time that we've been on has been around what's happening, reform, initiatives, different things like that. And I know the work that you all do, but how do lenders, how do realtors, how does everyone get involved in, I guess, feeding their voice to CHLA and helping you all, you know, be great advocates? I mean, you're supporting all of us, but how do we support you?
Yeah, thank you. There's a constant interplay between lenders and their trade group where we decide what should happen. In the case of CHLA, there's a weekly call that all lenders can participate in. I always say, and you all are busy, right? People are hustling. They're trying to close loans. They're trying to understand the market, and they're trying to serve their customers. I always advocate for people who belong to CHLA, as does Atlantic Bay, to come to one of the Washington fly-ins that we have, and Atlantic Bay often does. Why? Because policymakers in Washington, members of Congress, senators, regulators, FHFA, they talk to people like me all the time. And at some point, I'm okay, right? But I'm not the person making the mortgages. And when someone like you comes in and sits down with members of Congress, the senators, the regulators, the White House staff, you have a perspective that I cannot get. You talk to real Americans on a daily basis. I don't. And I always tell people, I can tell that these policymakers in Washington, they'll tune me out after a while, but they listen very intently to someone like you. So if you're in a lender shop and you say, I'm too busy to go to Washington, I would say your voice counts more than mine. And I've never seen a fly-in where real lenders didn't have a material impact on the people we talk to. And this includes trigger leads. I can talk about trigger leads. Oh, fine. When a lender comes in and talks about trigger leads in great detail and explains how much stress it's putting on families trying to close on a home or move, policymakers listen. They listen much more carefully. So do that. The other thing I'll say is, and this can be tricky, but because I always tell people, if you work in the zipper manufacturing world, you don't have to think about Washington at all. You don't have to think about your local member of the House of Representatives or your senator. But in mortgages, you do.
Yeah.
So the real gold standard, if people can do it, is have a relationship with your congressional delegation. They have local offices. You can go in and talk to them. You can get to know a local staffer in the office and just keep them up to date on what you're seeing. Because again, this whole industry, as you know, is highly regulated and watched by DC. So you got to pay attention to them so that they don't make a mistake that hurts you. If you want to be in the zipper industry, you don't have to worry about Washington at all. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad always said, learn a trade.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. I should have listened to him. Hey, you know, one thing, Rob, that I also want to go back on and the way that you talked about it is there, all this is happening. And like you said, you have big banks. And a lot of my career, I worked for bank owned mortgage companies. So that was, you know, I wouldn't be here today if I didn't have that experience. So always, you know, positives and negatives on both sides. But I think one of the things it's important for people to realize that you touched on as well is by having more resources and opportunities in the market. So your big lenders, your mid-sized lenders, your small lenders, right? It gives the client more options. It gives them, you know, more choices. And I always tell our team, which is pretty amazing if you think about it, when they, when a homeowner, you know, looking for whether it's their dream home, their second, third home, whatever it may be, when they choose their lender, they're choosing you over literally every other lender, not just in the country, but in the world, because they can go online and it's just, you know, it's not just here in the market and you're competing against 400 or whatever the number may be lenders. They're competing against everybody in the world. So when they choose you, there's a lot of, you know, trust and faith there. Yeah. So I think what you were touching on before, just about how important it is that we do continue with whatever, you know, whatever path Fannie and Freddie go down, that we do continue to have a very strong pool of different size lenders, you know, out there in the market is very important for our industry.
You know, you made a good point that I neglected to make, and that is one of the primary functions of Fannie and Freddie is that most of CHLA members don't have the heft to tap into international capital markets. Obviously, big banks do. And Fannie and Freddie are there to be the transmission between community lenders and the national and international capital markets. It's one of the key reasons we have Fannie and Freddie, and one of the key reasons we didn't want them vaporized back in 2013 and 2014. And the cash window, you know, the ability for lenders, I mean, obviously you can choose to go through an aggregator, and that's fine. If the pricing's right, you do it. But you always have the ability to go direct to Fannie or Freddie through the cash window or a security swap. Some of the larger community lenders do that. And that's a function that, again, is key to having a diverse set of lenders in this country. We don't want to roll up the financial world into 3, 4, or 5 large banks. And it's truly a gift. I tell people, Americans don't realize how gifted they are, that they have small lenders to be able to go to and do face-to-face, right? Have you ever had a relationship with a large corporation? Doesn't matter if it's a bank. And you run into an issue and you got to dial an automated phone line, you go crazy and you never talk to anyone live. And the beauty of a small lender is if you really want to talk to them direct, quickly, or face-to-face, an American can do that. And it doesn't work that way in other countries.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny here. at our office, my office is tends to be close to the front door, and it amazes me how many people still come in to make their payment in person. So
I love it.
Yeah, I think I'm one of the few people that still uses checks, but you know, again, it's just a creature of habit. One thing, I know we're getting a little bit close to time here, and like I said, it's always amazing how fast all of our time goes. But I did want to ask you real quick, I never want to end going. You build momentum going up. You don't want to be coming down. But there, you know, around when you look at kind of home ownership in today's market, is your outlook, you know, is it positive? Is it concerning? Is it negative? And if you want to, you know, kind of relate that specifically to the VA buyer as well, that would be great. But just what's the overall outlook as you're seeing? You mentioned before things like affordability and the challenges that our very young people are having entering into the home buying space. What's your overall outlook right now?
Only fools predict the weather or long-term bond rates. So I'll just note that on the bright side, I think a year ago, mortgage rates were closer to 7%, right? Now they're down to what, 6.1213 or
we're
so.
We're dipping into the fives, right? Dipping.
Are we? Okay, so that's a big deal. That's a big deal. So 100 basis points is very meaningful to veterans and anyone trying to buy a home. You and I talked earlier about a somewhat esoteric topic, which is the spread between mortgages and the 10-year mortgages based on the 10-year treasury rate, but the spread historically is 140 to 170 basis points. Today it's 215. So that's still elevated. Mortgage rates could come down further, even if the 10-year treasury stayed the same, if Fannie and Freddie bought more MBS on a temporary basis. I'm worried like everybody about the price of homes. It's amazing how they're expensive everywhere now in a way that wasn't the case when you and I were younger. And I don't have the answer for that. We need more starter homes, obviously, but you don't see a lot being built, partly because of land use regulations, zoning, the cost of lumber, et cetera, et cetera. We need some bright minds to figure out how to get more smaller homes built. The classic, modest sized 3-bedroom, 2-bedroom home to allow a family to get started when they might have one child or maybe two. You just don't see that inventory anymore. But I think there's good news on the mortgage interest rate front. I worry about the job market for young people with AI. I don't know a lot about AI, but I hear oftentimes now that some of those basic jobs, I mean, not everybody goes to college, but for those who do, you get out and you're a research assistant. Well, guess what? There's no research assistants anymore. It's almost better days to go into a trade. So again, it's a mixed bag, but I will say the obvious, which is life's been good for people like you and me and at our age. We have a lot of home equity. We refied into a super cheap mortgage. You know, assets have done well in the stock market. But for young Americans of all stripes, they're having a hard time. And I think collectively we have to, everyone, in, not just in the mortgage industry, but in the country, really figure out how to make things work better for younger families. Because I know young kids who want to work hard, they can't really land a job. They want to buy a home if they have a job, and if the prices are too high. It's tough out there for young families. There's no getting around that. I'm not ending on a down note, but I think we have to be clear-eyed about the challenges going forward.
Yeah, and you know, if I look back kind of over the summers, the things that we touched on, I think it's very key to bring about that awareness. So if you are a home buyer, really in any stage, it's key that you have that awareness of, you know, what are the opportunities out there, and how do you get the education around the tools and resources that are available to you? We talked a lot about, about VA loans. So if you are a veteran or active duty, making sure that you're finding out as much as you can about that, and then setting your goals, and then what's it going to take to get there? So it may not be today, but is it in the next, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? And what path do you need to take to get there? Because I've talked to a number of different builders and a number of different realtors in the market, and it's all together. We need to reshape, like, what does affordability, look like?
Yeah, absolutely.
Before people have that concept of, hey, affordability means I can get a 2-story, 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom home with a 2-car garage. Now it might be a 3 and a 2 or a 3 and a 1.5. And just, again, feeling like you can start. It seems like in America, we always want to, you know, we want to run before we even walk. You know, there might need to be steps to it. I don't know if you'd agree to that, but that was kind of my take on it.
Oh, listen, my parents, I think their first home was one bathroom, and it was one finished bedroom, one partway finished bedroom, and then a completely finished space that eventually someday would become a bedroom. So they started off very modestly.
And then you had a tent. You slept in a tent outside.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Rob, it's been great to have you on. It wouldn't be a Lending Forward episode if I didn't ask you how you want to lend it forward for the rest of the year.
I'll tell you how I lend it forward the rest of the year is they call it the two-phase economy. I have been volunteering to hand out food at homeless sites, number one. Number two, I've increased my giving to the food bank. I'm just very aware that we can't just be complacent at our age in life, number one. And number two, the mark you want to leave behind now that we've provided for our families, it's time to not just focus on ourselves. That's my take on it. So I want to just wake up more often and say, how can I help some of the issues in this country? Because they're there. They're somewhat acute. Even if you live in an upper middle class town, more and more people are going to the food banks in these towns. And so I'm just trying to be aware that, life's been good to me, but I got to think harder about how to help other people as I get older. Now that I've been raising my kids, I want to see what else I can do here. But I also agree with you. The beauty of being in the mortgage business is you get to be part of people's happiest moment in their life. Mm-hmm. Because buying the first home, I would say after getting married, having children, buying that first home is about the happiest moment you can conceive of. And you get to be part of that. And that's a big deal in life.
Yeah, way to nail the ending. I mean, that's a great message for hopefully our listeners to take forward with them. And thank you again for the work that you're doing, because you just mentioned kind of doing some work more in the community, but I think the work that CHLA does overall is work in the community, because you are out there working for all of us in that lending community that's helping people get into homes and have that great moment that you mentioned. So, Rob, I appreciate you being on today. I hope you'll come on again and we can dive into even further topics. So in this upcoming weekend, I'll root harder for Harvard and Syracuse, and we'll see which one of them gets a win.
Yeah, well, they need the help, Bill. Do all you can.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube, and LinkedIn. Catch us every other Thursday with a brand new episode, and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.